Ready to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Can the people in the back hear? Did that guy say, what did you say? Well, I can't turn the speaker on. Turn what? What?
They'll turn them on.
They'll turn them on. Okay. It's not us. Jesus, I was afraid I was wrong again. I've been a failure all my life, and I have a fear of that. Anyway, it says read. Says read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Is there anyone attending this meeting tonight in the first 30 days? If so, will you please stand up, holler out, do something? First 30 days of sobriety? Hi, Steve. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Long time. I'll tell you what, I ain't going to tell you that now. Is there any people from outside Maricopa County who would like to introduce themselves? Please don't.
You never stop if you do.
No. It is customary in Arizona to read a portion of the chapter 5 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and tonight we have Betty E. to do that for us.
My support system works. Thank you. Good evening. My name is Betty, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Betty.
How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C. That God could and would if He were sought.
Is there anyone here tonight celebrating a birthday would like to be acknowledged?
Bob Morris, favorite. 6 years.
Bob Morris, our state delegate, excuse me, our area delegate, celebrating 6 years today. That's when you should have blown the horn. Okay. I have here an imitation pearl earring with phony diamonds that I'm sure will not be reclaimed.
Oh, that looks pretty good.
You can have it. What's next? Okay. I was given a story to tell tonight, and I read it. I didn't want to read it, but I did. I wanted to tell it to you people rather than read it, because I can't remember stories. I screw them up every time. And I took it to our leader here for this. I would like to acknowledge this time. At this time, considering that that Art Lindsay has organized, appointed, administered this entire confab with volunteer alcoholic help, he's done one hell of a fine job. Those of you who are not alcoholic will not understand that. And those of you who have never tried it won't understand it either. But I got his permission to give you this story. And I'll use it for reference, but maybe I can tell it. But I don't want to screw it up. Anyway, your time's coming. He's getting restless already. A new priest was at his first mass, was so scared he couldn't speak. And after it was over, he asked the Monsignor how he'd done, and he told him that really not very well, but you will improve with time. But I recommend that at the next service you add a little vodka to the water that you drink, which he did. And after that service, he asked the Monsignor how he had done, and he said, "Well, you did improve, but you made a few mistakes that I would like to review with you." He says, "First off, there are not 10 commandments, there's 12. There are not 12 disciples, there were 10. David slew Goliath, he didn't kick the shit out of him. We do not refer to Jesus Christ as the late J.C. And next Sunday, there is a taffy pulling contest at St. Peter's Church, not a Peter pulling contest at St. Taffy's. And last and final, we have Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, not Big Daddy, Junior, and the Spook. If you don't like that, blame Art. If you do, I'll take the credit. Anyway, I've learned everything I know today. I feel that I have learned since I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I often say to people, I may be an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. And I'm a transplant in Arizona. And before coming to Arizona, I was a transplant into Southern California because I got sober in Las Vegas, Nevada. And for those, there's always people moving on to new areas, and I hear people coming back from vacations in Nebraska and Florida, and they have nothing but condemnation and criticism for the AA they have found there. And I got some advice that I learned and have observed because I'm a sensitive alcoholic and I'm not stupid. And that is that in Orange County, they don't give a damn how we did it in Las Vegas. And in Phoenix, Arizona, they don't give a damn how we did it in Orange County. And I have tried to remember that. I now come to the most important part of my reason for being up here, is to introduce our speaker. Al Marinol is my sponsor. I didn't select him first because he wasn't the person who was there to select me. My first sponsor died when I was nine years sober. And because I'd been sober that long and had a lot of pigeons of my own, I didn't think I needed a sponsor. I had moved down to Orange County, and I had me three new pigeons I was working with at one time, and I had them over at my house this night, and I used to teach Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I still do. The only reason I started to teach Alcoholics Anonymous was I kept hearing people in meetings say, I'm learning, I'm learning, I'm learning. And I thought, my God, if they're all learning, somebody ought to start teaching. And I did. But I had these guys over at my place, and I had them sitting on the couch, and I was standing up so I could talk down to them, which is a no-no, it says in the book. We never talk down from any spiritual plane. But I found I could keep their attention. And this particular session was dedicated to the importance of strong, singular sponsorship, which I happen to believe in, which because my sponsor believed in it, and the people that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous believe in it because that's what I taught them. And one of these characters, who had been born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona, by the way, his name was Jim Sinnott. He was a brighter of the three, and I paused to light a cigarette, and he said, do you have a sponsor? And being quick-witted and on my feet and hopefully in charge of the situation, I said, no, but I'm going to get one. So the next Saturday, I called Alan asking if I could come up and talk to him because I had known him for some, I suppose at that time, 10 years, nine and a half, whatever it was, since I was 14 months sober. I met Al, and I drove up, and we had lunch, and he invited a bunch of guys over, and I sat at this table, and I think there was six or seven there, and the total sobriety was almost 200 years, and I had, at that time, less than 10, and I felt intimidated, and I didn't ask him anything, and I drove back home to Tustin, California, and as soon as I got home, I called him, and I said, can I come up and talk to you again next Saturday? And he said, well, you just left. He's quite abrupt at times, as you'll find out in a little bit. And straight to the point, and I said I'd like to come up next Saturday. And I drove up, he said, okay. And when he came to the door, let me in, I asked him if he'd be my sponsor. He paused for a minute, and he said, there's some things about you I'd like to change. He said, I think I'd appreciate the opportunity. And he's been my sponsor ever since. See, mostly we're friends. We share a lot of things. There's one thing I've learned from Al that I can do that not many people have been able to do. I can disagree with Al without he and I getting to be disagreeable. A lot of people know Al Marinol in Alcoholics Anonymous, as he will tell you probably. He's been sober a long time, since April 17, 1941. But seldom have I ever found anyone who was indifferent to Al Marinol. Now, I don't know if that's a mark in Alcoholics Anonymous or not, but they either love him very much or they hate him. And I think he probably keeps coming back just to frustrate those that hate him. But anyway, I'm going to introduce Al like this tonight about a story about a couple of anthropologists who was doing some moonlighting in the laboratory and some experimenting, and they got fooling around with a Bengal tiger and a talking parakeet. And lo and behold, they made a match. And there was a hybrid from this match, and it came to be there in the laboratory. And one of these characters turned to the other one and he said, What are we going to call it? He said, I'll be goddamned if I know, but when he talks, I'm going to listen.
That's what we call diarrhea of the tonsils, you know? My name is Al Marino, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
As he mentioned to you, I've been sober now for 37 years and 6 months, a little over. And that's a hell of a long time. Without a drink. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles when we were the only group on the coast. And there were 34 members. And they were mean. They were all old and they were mean. And there were three of us in the group that were less than 40 years old. And they felt that anybody less than 40 years old couldn't possibly be an alcoholic because they couldn't have drunk enough in their lifetime up to that time. They had the idea that you had to drink for at least 15 years, a fifth a day, to qualify for AA. Now, of course, we find out that that's very erroneous. It isn't the amount of booze that we drink that causes the disease. It's how the stuff affects us. That's the important thing. We had the book and nothing else, and I think there were between 1,000 and 1,500 AAs in all the world at that time. And now, of course, we've got about a million. They didn't know how to start a meeting. They didn't have any format for a meeting. So God bless our little founder on the West Coast. His name was Mortimer J. Little Jewish fella. Wonderful man. He says, I suggest that we read a portion of chapter 5 of how it works. The 12 steps are the basis and the foundation of our sobriety. So that was done. Then some ding-a-ling come along with the idea that we ought to possibly recite the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. And believe me, it hit the fan. I never saw such fighting and argument and throwing of chairs in my life. It was beautiful, just beautiful. Now they're going to make a religion out of AA. Now we're going to have a cult, you know. It was wonderful. So after ruining a couple good meetings, why, they finally took a vote, and they won by one vote that we recite the Lord's Prayer. I was very much against it. Now, at that time, we didn't have an office, we didn't have a telephone, we had nothing. So there was a little ad running in the paper like you see in these small towns around the country. If you have an alcoholic problem, write to post office box so-and-so, and the bottom we had Alcoholics Anonymous. And we got a lot of letters, a lot of mails on this, and we called them letters of inquiry. We didn't call them 12-step work because very seldom did the alcoholic himself write in. They stacked these letters at the top of the dais, and they divide them up west side, north side, east side, south side. There'd be stacks of them, and you go up and take a half a dozen. And it worked out very, very good, because you could take a dozen or more and go out and make a couple calls a night and get thrown out of the nicest homes, you know. Or you could go out and make three or four in one night if you wished. Now, at that time, we didn't have this sort of an unwritten law whereby a male should not call on a female unless accompanied by a female, because we get into some kind of screwy situations. In fact, we just had one female in AA then. So there was a big, good-looking guy from Beverly Hills who had a gorgeous Cadillac, and he still had his wristwatch, and I didn't like him. A man with all that couldn't be an alcoholic, you know. My problem was finances. It wasn't booze, you know. So he took his usual number of inquiries, and on a nice Wednesday afternoon, it was beautiful, and he had this one call, and he looked up the address. It was a gorgeous area of Beverly Hills, and he went over there and rang the doorbell, and a gorgeous gal came to the door with nothing on but just a very thin nightgown and a highball in her hand. And he said, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, "That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I wrote a letter. As you can see, I'm not very well." She was getting over a real bad one. And she had this glass, and she said, "Follow me." And he went back, and she had the bedroom was on the first floor. So she laid down on the bed and was sipping her drink, and over here was a table with all kind of fine booze on it and the mix and everything. So he takes the chair and he pulls it up to the bed to give her the big AA pitch. Well, being a good qualified member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a good drunk, naturally he got drunk with her. Then, being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a good alcoholic, he got in bed with her. And then her old man came home. And he sued AA. But he couldn't find us. Then at that time, we passed laws. You know, we had the book. This is all we needed. But we passed laws. And one of the finest laws we had was, if anybody got drunk over two times, he couldn't come to AA anymore.
He said, "Now it's too loud. Back off a little bit."
Oh, I'm too loud, huh? Well, that's what the guy said. Turn the damn thing down a little bit, that's all. We had a couple of members. In those days, we kept good watch on them, and these two members used to go out and get drunk, and they'd walk into a bar, and they'd brag about being members of AA, and then they'd get drunk, and they were ruining our reputation. So we had quite a confab over this. And we had a special meeting out on the street corner after the meeting, you see. And we passed this law that they couldn't come in anymore after they got drunk twice. So at the next meeting, old Pete Cunningham, he's there all dead of that 34 but four of us now, he ran up to the front of the meeting and he had the book in his hand. Of course, this is all we had. This is all you need, really. And he says, "I've been looking through this book and I've been studying this book and I can't find out anywhere in the book where we have a right to bar anybody from AA, no matter how many times they get drunk. It says in the book, anyone with an alcoholic problem is welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." So here we had spent maybe two or three meetings and 25 hours worrying about throwing these guys out, and we couldn't throw them out if we wanted to. These were beautiful days, and I was with, I was with Pete one day, and I said, "How long have these people been sober?" Well, he says, "Mort's been sober for a year, and so-and-so's been sober 6 months, and the rest of us have been sober by the week." And I says, "We haven't proved much, have we?" And he says, "No." He says, "But we're hanging on to each other like drowning men. And I think it's going to work." You see, no one had proved anything up to this time. And he says, "I think it's going to work." Well, along about this time, of course, the war came along, 42. And we had moved to a larger hall. And now we have about 600 membership after about a year, from 34 to 600. And it's the only meeting in Southern California, and it was once a week on Friday nights. And they came from Santa Barbara and San Bernardino and Bakersfield and all down along the coast to this one big meeting. And everybody looked to that meeting like 4th of July or Halloween, or you can put them all together, New Year's Eve, because we'd all get down there. I didn't have a car then. I had to change buses two or three times to get over to this hall at 2200 West 7th. And there was a fellow there that had owned this hall. His name was Farber. And this was sort of a Jewish center where they had all their big samatzes and all the junk, you know, over there. And all you could always smell food over there. And he had several great, big, beautiful rooms. And when we went over to ask him if we could meet there, the name Alcoholics got him. And he says, "I'll let you know in a week." So when we went back, he says, "Yes, you can certainly have this place because you don't drink." He says, "Alcoholics scared me to death." And this guy Farber was so wonderful, he had a great deal to do with our success. Because a lot of times we didn't have any dough. And he just put it on the book. And I know that there's maybe $1,000 or $2 that we never did get to him. And he never complained once. Because he says, "This is the greatest thing that's ever happened since sex. This is it." So our group is now up to 600, and they come from all directions. And the meeting would start about 8:30, an open meeting until 9:30. 9:30 we would break up, and all the non-alcoholics would go upstairs into another room. And I think this is the first time that we ever had a group meeting of what they call now Al-Anon. We call that the family group. And my present wife was very much involved in this, God bless her. And they used to go up and they had all this thing, this family group. They didn't have any Al-Anon books, they didn't have anything, but it was a participation, and there were a lot of them. It was beautiful. Then at 9:30, well, we would start the close meeting. And I'll tell you, that was the toughest bunch of people I ever got involved with. If you were up there making a talk and you started feeling sorry of yourself and giving a case history of yourself, they'd boo you off the stand. They say, to hell with that. What's keeping you sober? So you'd have to get up there and talk about the steps and what you thought how you thought that you were practicing them and so forth. They were tough, very, very tough, and it was good. It was good for me. It was good for everybody. Then the meeting would run maybe to 11:30 or 12. We had no stopping time. And then we'd have the donuts and coffee after the meeting, and those whole 600 of us would get together in there and get home maybe at 2, 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was just beautiful. Now, I'm getting to be an old duck, and I can remember those things so well. It was so beautiful. Just wonderful. It was great. And then the war came along. We didn't have any gas. We advised everybody to start groups in their own neighborhoods, in their own areas. And there were a bunch of us that used to go from here to there, to San Berdu and all these different places. Every night in the week, we were out trying to help somebody get a group started. Now we got 1,000 groups down there. We got too damn many, but we got 1,000. And the old mother group, old 2200 West 7th, gradually faded away and died. But it did its job. It did its job. And there are many, many things that we started down there. We had the first central office that they ever had in the world. We never sent any money to New York then. We didn't have to because they didn't even have an office. It was just Bill and Lois then. So every time we'd get 1,000 ahead, we'd throw a big bust. Get a band and have a big dance and everything but the booze. Now, I'm a trombone player. I'm a musician. 40 years I played slide trombone. I come from Idaho. I graduated from the University of Idaho back in 1926. That's a hell of a long time ago. And I followed music all my life, and I decided that I'd better get out to Hollywood after being on the road, and I worked in Chicago for many years. And I got married to a very intolerant woman. She would get mad if I didn't come home for 3 or 4 days. One of those silly people, you know. So we had 2 daughters, and we moved to Los Angeles, and I moved in on right off of Beverly Boulevard, about 2 blocks. I wanted to get in on the studio work, and I did. Right away, I had a fine reputation, considered one of the 4 best in the world when I was younger. So I had a fine reputation, made lots of Victor records, you know, and the old baloney, the whole business. So I got a lot of work, and everything's going along fine. But, of course, I had a little trouble with that flit every once in a while. Right across the street was another musician. His name was Jack. Jack was a saxophone player, a bassoon player, an oboe player. He was a brilliant, brilliant musician. He had perfect pitch, which God endows 1 out of every 10,000. He could write, he could arrange, he could compose. He had the world by the tail, and he was the lousiest drunk I ever met in my life. And Jack and I organized our own AA group way back in 1934. It was considered one alcoholic helping the other. Now, if I was dying in the morning, I'd call across the street to Jack. And Jack would get over there with a jug and give me some medicine and get me well. Just like AA, one drunk helping the other. When Jack was dying in the morning, I used to do the same thing for him. And we had the finest little AA group you ever saw in your life. One drunk helping the other. Jack was a very odd type of a drunk, and I'd never run into one like this before. He was a bed drinker. So one morning I come in with him, and he would lay in bed for days as long as he could get a jug. And I come in this morning, and I says, Jack, you're the most terrible drunk I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen anything like you. How can you lay in bed and drink? Why don't you be like me, go out and hoop and holler and have a big time? He says, I don't get pinched as often as you do I? I said, that's right. Now, down around the corner in Beverly Boulevard was a beautiful, beautiful liquor store. Old Sam Cohn owned this liquor store. And I was a smart alcoholic, so I figured I'd set myself up a nice charge account, which we called a cuff. I got him up to 2 jugs, and he wouldn't cuff me for any more jugs. So I told Jack, I says, old Sam's got a nice liquor store, but I told him the story, and Jack says, well, you don't work old Sam right. And I said, what do you mean I don't work him right? He says, I owe him $500. I says, how in hell did you get him up to $500? He says, using my head, dummy, I'm using my head. So I says, what'd you do? Well, he says, I owed him 25, I paid him 12 and a half. Owed him 50, paid him 25. Owed him 100, paid him 50. Now, it took me quite a few months, but I got him up to 500. So what do you think of that? I says, you're a genius, an absolute genius. So one day we're dying for a drink, and Jack says, let's see Sam. And I says, Sam isn't going to give us a jug. And he says, watch me work. So we walked in the liquor store, and he says, Sam, give me a jug of so-and-so. And Sam says, I can't do it. I just can't do it. He says, you owe me $500, and I need it very badly right now. He says, can't you borrow that from some friends? And he says, oh, I got no friends who'll owe me $500. He says, hawk your instruments. He says, they're all in hawk now. And went on and on and on, and finally Sam says, go down to the bank and borrow it. And Jack says, you mean on a personal note? And Sam says, yeah. Well, he says, Sam, I need a co-signer on that note. And Sam says, I'll co-sign. Along about this time, I was having a great deal of trouble. My wife would leave. I'd come home drunk, and she'd take the kids and leave. If I didn't come home, she'd take the kids and leave. That's what you call a separation, and it's very, very costly. I had a hell of a bad time, you know. So finally, I got a wonderful picture coming up that meant many thousands of dollars, and I'm on a drunk, and I can't get sober to save my soul. So in the meantime, I had run into an old friend of mine by the name of Andy Sechrist. Now, Andy and I worked with Paul Whiteman for some time, and Andy was a fantastic trumpet player, but oh, what a drunk. They were always worse than me. And I met him down at the Palomar Ballroom before it burned down, and Benny Goodman was playing there, and I says, come on up to the bar, Andy, and I'll buy you a drink. And Andy says, I'm not drinking. And I says, what? You're not drinking? He says, no. He says, I took a cure. I says, that's enough. I don't want to hear any more. So when I got in this position, I called Andy, and I says, Andy, what was the name of that cure that you took? He says, it was the Halco cure, but don't take it. He says, it's terrible. He says, I've been sober 2 years, and I'm ready to flip my lid. I'm going to cut my throat. I'm going to cut my wrist. He says, it's awful. Well, I says, that's all I want to know, the Halco. So I called them up, and in 10 minutes flat, they were down there and with their ambulance and took me out to the hospital out in Culver City. $150. That was a lot of money then. And they gave me a physical examination, and I'm dying. I'm shaking like a leaf. I'm just dying. I'm trying to get over this drunk, and I couldn't make it. So he checked my heart, my blood pressure, and everything. I says, what are you going to do to me? He said, just give you the cure. And I says, well, what does that comprise of? I says, why all this examination? Well, we want to be sure you're in good shape. So they took all my clothes away from me and gave me one of these little short nightgowns, you know, and put me to bed. And here's 4 nurses standing out there. There were 2 male and 2 female. And the males were gay, so we had 4 females out there, you know. And the doctor. And then one of these gay kids, he swished in with a tray of booze, and he says, here, have your pick. And I picked out what? And he poured out a glass full. They held my mouth open, and they poured it down me. And my God, when it hit bottom, the lights went on, and my shakes went away, and I said, for $150, this ain't too bad, you know. Then they let me get as drunk as I possibly could, and they hit me in the chest with a great big needle containing that stuff called apomorphine, and I started to puke. My head went over the side of that bed, and I'm telling you, it was so bad, my eyeballs were dragging on the floor. You could have knocked them off with a stick. It was awful. And then they took me into another room and gave me 150 high enemas. And they liked that. They liked that. Then they put me back to bed, and they gave me another shot of something to make me perspire, and I soaked through the mattress. And this was just one treatment. And I got one of these every 4 hours for 3 days and 3 nights. And believe me, when I got out of that joint, I was as pure as the day I was born. And you pay for it yet, you know. 2 weeks I was drunk again. I wanted to find out if this insurance policy was worth a damn. Didn't mount. Then the next thing was the psychiatric treatment. You know what Bill said? No human power could help us. The psychiatric treatment. Oh, my God. This guy was a fine psychiatrist because he spoke broken English. And you couldn't pronounce his name. And we had 3 seances together. And you know something? After 3 seances, he says, "You're perfectly normal." He says, "I don't know why you came here." He says, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you mentally at all." And I says, "I knew that. But my wife and my family and all my friends talked me into coming over here." It reminds me of the story of John. John was a beautiful, wonderful alcoholic. He was one of those walking alcoholics. Never fallen down, walking all the time. And he lived in this town of maybe 100,000. Came from a fine family. All alcoholics come from fine families, don't we? They say, "Look at him going down the street there." A couple old biddies would say, "Bouncing from one side, and he comes from such a fine family." All drunks come from fine families. Well, anyway, John came from a fine family. And his family talked him into going to the leading psychiatrist in town, so he went to this psychiatrist. And he takes seance after seance with him, and he's always drunk. And finally he come to him this time, and the psychiatrist says, "John, we're going to change the whole method. All I want you to do is answer my questions honestly." And John says, "Okay." He said, "Now what would happen to you if I cut off your left ear?" And John says, "My hearing would be impaired about 50%. He says, "That's right. Now we're getting somewhere. Now what would happen to you if I cut off your right ear?" And John says, "I wouldn't be able to see." He says, "What? Why wouldn't you be able to see?" He says, "My hat would fall down over my eyes." And then we moved up to Tahunga. My oldest daughter had asthma, so I used to get sober once in a while for a few days. And we moved up 2,000 feet altitude, and this asthma would just disappear. In fact, she still lives up there. And this is the lonesomest town in the world, especially way back in 35, along in there, 36. It was terrible. And I'm lonesome, and of course I have to get drunk because I'm lonesome. But I can still do my studio work when I get a call. And I got acquainted with an old Catholic priest up there by the name of Father Dennis Falvey. And I had been raised a Catholic, but hadn't been back for 23 years. I was what those guys call a fallen away Catholic. You know, a fallen away. Big deal. So I got acquainted with this padre, and he was a hell of a swell guy. He was one of the most wonderful men, I would say, that I've ever met in all my life. And he talked me into helping him get a choir together. Well, he didn't do much help. I got the choir together. It was something to do. We had a good little choir. And I rehearsed it. I had sung in a choir when I was a kid. And we're going along great guns, you know. But I wouldn't show up all the time. And I'd end up at his back door saying, "Father, loan me 5 while I get over this drunk." And he'd always come through with a 5 and say, "My boy, don't spend it all in one place." He never once did he ever say, "Why don't you quit drinking?" So I says, "This guy most likely was an alcoholic himself. He was a terrible drunk himself. He knows so much of how to handle a drunk." Never once did he bawl me out about drinking. Not once. So, of course, the day came. Christmas was coming along. I'd been sober about maybe 3 months for the first time in many, many years. We're going to have a beautiful Christmas this year. Bicycles for the kids, the girls, the 2 daughters, and a lot of nice things for them. We're going to open our Christmas presents 7 o'clock Christmas Eve. I'm going to conduct the choir at the High Mass at 8 o'clock in the morning for Dennis down at the church. Everything's all solid. I'd been getting an awful lot of work. I bought a new car. We're going to have the nicest Christmas we ever had. And a couple days before Christmas, I got a call from Republic Studios. Now, Republic Studios is sort of a bread-and-butter studio for musicians at that time. All you had to do was play high and fast for the horse operas. You know, the horses galloping, you ought to have them. Gene Autry was there, you know. Gene Autry made $10 billion at Republic, singing out of tune. Gene is a wonderful guy and a great alcoholic, you know. He spends half his time in a sanitarium. But Gene was so bad that he couldn't sing with the orchestra to make the songs for the screen, so he would do his tape on the side with just a guitar. And then they'd call in the orchestra, and we'd put earphones on our ears, and we'd watch our music, and when he'd go sharp, we'd put a line up, and when he'd go flat, we'd put a line down. And then we'd back his music with the orchestra, and when we got that line, we'd go, and when we go down, boo. And we changed keys two or three times in the chorus, and it sounded pretty good. And that was the studio. They called me, and they said, we're having a big party the day before Christmas on Stage A, which is the biggest stage in the deal, and it's going to start at 3 o'clock, and we want all you guys that play down here to come down and give us some music. It's okay with the union. Everything's all set up. And we're going to have all the food you want to eat and all the booze you want to drink. And I says, what kind of booze? He says, White Horse Scotch on down. I says, no champagne. He says, no champagne. I says, I'm not drinking anyway. He says, that's fine. So I told my wife about this. And she says, as I was walking out of the door, don't drink over 3 scotch and sodas. And I says, who said I was going to drink 3 scotch and sodas? If I can't drink, I'm not going to drink. I mean, can I have a fifth? I'm not going to start. And we got in a hell of a big beef. You know, I was very touchy about this, see? Very, very touchy. A little nervous. And we got in the damnedest fight you ever saw over how much I was going to drink or whether I was going to drink or not. And when I got in the car and I coasted down that hill, we were way up on a hill, I says, well, who would I got in mind? I've been married to that gal for 14 years. She ought to know how much I can drink. 4 scotch and sodas. And I said, oh, who the hell wants to drink 4 scotch and sodas? So I went down and I did my bit, and I'm cussing and swearing and mad. And over here, when I got through playing, is all the fiddlers and those guys eating all the good food. And over on that side is all my pals, you know, the brass man and the drummer and the piano player and all my, over there nipping that beautiful booze. It was all help-yourself style. It was just gorgeous. So I packed up my horn and I walked over there, and here's old Joe. And I says, Joe, I haven't seen you for ages. How are you, Joe? And he says, fine, I saw you last week. He says, step up and wet your beak. And I says, oh, no. Oh, no. I'm not drinking. I'm on the wagon. He says, what a hell of a time to go on the wagon. I says, yeah, but I'm on the wagon. He says, I stuck around. Some more guys come in. A couple gals, a couple actresses there in the set. I says, well, I don't care if I do. So when I got out of jail Christmas night, about 9:30, I'd called my lawyer, who was an ex-musician, and I says, where in hell have you been? He said, I was drunk myself, and I had to come down and get you out and get sober. He says, don't bawl me out. I had smashed up my car. It was, a blackout. I used to have the greatest ability to get in blackouts, and I don't remember except that I know I hit a telephone post head on. I didn't even bother about trying to glance off it. I hit it head on. Brand new car. I'm in pretty bad shape. And you know that Christmas morning, the Salvation Army was outside of that cell bumming that damn drum and singing those damn Christmas things. And if I could have got to them, I'd have choked every one of them, because I'd just been drunk one night. I was in pretty good shape in the morning, you know. Well, when I left that jail with my lawyer, I tell you, if somebody had handed me a gun, I'd have killed myself. I was never so low in all my life. Here I had done so well up to this time. I wasn't down there to help. Well, it was awful. Well, to make a long story short, I went down to see the old padre. And he says, you were in jail, weren't you? And I says, yeah. How did you know? He says, I know you'd have been down here at Mass drunk or sober. And I says, I guess I better take the pledge. And he says, you can take the pledge if you want to, but it won't do you any good. I says, I got just as much faith as anybody else. I know non-Catholics that take the pledge and all that. He says, that doesn't make any difference. He says, Al, you're one of those guys. And I says, what do you mean, one of those guys? And he says, I can't explain it, but you're one of those guys. There's nothing going to help you. And I says, did you ever see anybody like me who ever got sober? And he says, come to think of it, just one. And I says, where and what was it all about? And he says, I had a little church in South Dakota. And the town drunk was the town drunk, and believe me, he was the drunk. And he says, it seemed like overnight he had a complete change in his personality and in